This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is making the rounds this week. She's in the Philadelphia area tomorrow, promoting her new book, Hard Choices. In it, she chronicles her time as Secretary of State for President Barack Obama. Benghazi, Iran, Afghanistan, Russia are all discussed, but the question many are asking is not answered, and that is, will she run for president a second time? However, some believe the book lays the groundwork for a campaign. Here to offer insight are Laura Brown, Program Director at George Washington University's Graduate School of Political Management, and author of a book about presidential elections called Jockeying for the American Presidency, The Political Opportunism of Aspirants. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
On the phone, Lissa Muscatine is a longtime speechwriter, senior advisor, and friend to Hillary Clinton, most recently serving as chief of speechwriting at the State Department. Welcome, Lissa.
Thanks for having me.
And Jennifer Rubin is the Washington Post's Right Turn blogger. Hello, Jennifer.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Let's start off with news of the week over remarks Hillary Clinton made to Diane Sawyer about how she and Bill were, quote, dead broke and in debt coming out of the White House. There's been a lot of chatter about that. The Clintons apparently struggled to piece together the resources for mortgages, plural, as well as Chelsea's education at Stanford, and the reaction came fast and furious. Lissa Muscatine, your reaction to this?
You know, this is ground that has been tread over so many times over so many years that I think it's almost amusing at this point that people are still so concerned about what the Clintons did years and years ago. And I know most people who are listening to the show remember, if they were remotely conscious at that time, that there were numerous investigations of the Clintons throughout the Clinton presidency, many of them really ill-founded, dismissed, found not to have great reason other than perhaps political motivation. And obviously that did cost a lot of money. The legal bills, not just for them, but for their staffers and many, many people who worked in the administration, were astronomical. And so, you know, I wish she had phrased it differently. I think it's a silly conversation to still be having in this day and age, and I think there's a lot more to look forward to when we think about her role in the future and what she's done in the past few years.
Jennifer Rubin?
I think you misunderstand what the question was and what her answer was. It wasn't about her income in the presidential years. It's been what she and her husband have been doing, first of all, once they left the White House, and secondly, what Hillary Clinton has been doing since she left the State Department. Now, let's go back to the Clinton presidency. They did have a lot of legal expenses, but their friends raised, saw one report, at least $4.5 million, and that was only up through 1999. So their legal bills were really, not totally borne by themselves. Also, upon leaving the White House, there were millions of dollars in book advances. And since that time, as she revealed when she decided to run for president between 2000 and 2008, their income was over $100 million. The reason this has come up is because people feel a little uncomfortable with her as a clear presidential candidate going around the country giving six-figure speaking fees, or getting six-figure speaking fees, from groups like hedge funds and groups like, you know, automobile dealerships. There's something a little bit unseemly, particularly since these people may eventually do business, or have business, if you will, with an administration she might hold.
I think the perception is that she's, Jennifer, I think the perception is that she's out of touch, perhaps, with the middle class. Laura Brown, an unusual misstep on Clinton's part?
Well, I think that we do have to look back to the 2008 campaign and recall that then-Senator Clinton, now former Secretary of State, Clinton had really an incredible connection with essentially the blue-collar workers in states like Pennsylvania and Ohio. And that was where much of her support was coming from during that contentious 2008 primary with then-Senator Barack Obama. And I see this as her having attempted to reconnect with those people who have now not really felt the benefits of any sort of recovery yet. And she was trying to say, I relate to you. Unfortunately, it does come off as being out of touch, because their world and their debts are such a different scale and magnitude that most people have no idea what she's talking about.
This is a perfect way to get into the book, because it begins when Hillary Clinton begins her time as Secretary of State with what was a painful and awkward meeting with Barack Obama after he'd won the Democratic nomination. It was a bruising campaign. Were you surprised at how quickly the political reconciliation came about, Laura?
No, I wasn't at all. This is exactly what presidential aspirants do. It is part of sort of the party tradition. If you look back to even things where there were open seats, for instance, in 1952, when the Republicans actually had quite a contentious nomination at the convention, what you saw was that Earl Warren was giving over delegates to Tom Dewey so Dewey could get Eisenhower elected. This party trading and understanding that everybody has an interest in a unified party is what happens on the heels of primaries.
Lissa, you're a close friend of Hillary Clinton's. Has it been a happy political marriage?
Well, I think it's a remarkable and very happy political marriage. They both gave a lot. You know, they both came from a position of having gone through the equivalent of a 15-round heavyweight boxing match, and you know, it was a tough campaign. There were a lot of things said that I think by their respective campaigns that were not appreciated, I think, by the other side, and I think the staffs remained, you know, locked in fierce combat, bad at least emotionally. Even as it wound down. And I think the fact that they could model exactly the kind of relationship that we hope for in a democratic system such as ours was wonderful. And I think they both deserve a lot of credit.
Let's get to Benghazi. How would you describe the tragedy at Benghazi, in which, of course, Ambassador Chris Stevens and three others died? How has Benghazi affected Hillary Clinton's political career? Jennifer Rubin, let's toss that to you.
I think it's affected it on two levels. One, it has brought forth this very strained, very difficult relationship that she has with critics and with the media at large. The Clintons certainly have been in the public eye, and they've gotten their share of inquiry and attacks like all folks have, but they tend to become exceptionally defensive, exceptionally, I think prickly is a good word, when challenged. And their best qualities do not come out when this happens. And I think that has, in some ways, put her back in this crouch. I'll share an anecdote. I was just in Morocco, of all places, and she's extremely popular there. And the reason is because she is so forthcoming, so relaxed, so engaging, that the real Hillary Clinton, which I think is very different than the public image of Hillary Clinton, comes forward. And it was fascinating to me because sometimes, you know, you can be more yourself when you're away from people who know you, and particularly the press. So I think that's on one level. The other level is that there really is a problem here, and has nothing to do with talking points and all that other, you know, stuff that congressional people are, you know, digging into for the umpteenth time. It really has to do with a basic competence and a basic policy and managerial issue. We had a situation following the Libyan war in which Libya devolved into jihadist terror. Other countries pulled their people out. We did not. Hillary Clinton says she ordered people to make sure we were secure. That obviously didn't happen. There were pleas from the ambassador for more security. She says, I believe her, that she was never aware of it, and people died. And the question is, how much responsibility does she bear for that? Did she lose track of what was going on in Libya? Was she told that this was supposed to be a great success, so maybe let's not focus on the jihadists? Did she have a system in place for elevating pleas for help like the ones she was getting from Chris Stevens?
Let me jump in for just a minute, Jennifer. The other issue, the other side says there was a video that apparently spurred this, the video in which Islam was maligned, allegedly. Laura Brown, let's have you come in here and give us your thoughts on this, on Benghazi.
Sure.
How much responsibility does Hillary Clinton bear here, ongoing?
Well, let me just say that I agree with Jennifer that the real issues around Benghazi is what was going on before the attack, not necessarily how the administration looked to sort of package or describe the attack later. I'm somebody who wholeheartedly believes there's no such thing as a conspiracy. There is only a cover-up. And usually those cover-ups have to do with the fact that people have made mistakes in government and they don't want those mistakes to essentially metastasize and become huge problems for wherever it is they are working in government. And I think it is fair to acknowledge that there were difficulties in Benghazi prior to the attacks. There were security concerns. We would not have had the number of CIA agents in that compound if there had not been serious concerns about what was happening. So really, I would argue that what is going to go on for Hillary in this situation is really a bigger question, as Jennifer pointed out, about her management and competency with regard to foreign policy, because she put forth in the 2008 campaign that she could answer the red phone in the 3 a.m. call. And so this story specifically undercuts that narrative, and that's where it becomes an electoral challenge for her.
Lisa Muscatine?
Well, you know, I think this has been studied by the media, by Congress, by others who've investigated it, also at the State Department. And it's a tragedy. You started off the question referring to it that way, I believe, and that certainly was what it was and remains what it was. And certainly when there's a loss of life of people who are working for you as Secretary of State, it's a personal blow as well as a professional blow. And, you know, I think in terms of her competency, there really is no doubt, and I think the vast majority of Americans who have watched her over the last 4 years, 8 years, 20 years, realize that this is a woman of exceptional leadership quality, exceptional intelligence, exceptional commitment to public service. Has she had her ups and downs? Obviously, yes. Anybody who's been in the public eye for that long does. Nobody makes perfect decisions in every instance. But I think to suggest that this is somehow a measure of her qualities of leadership, her capacity to have been the chief diplomat for this country for 4 years, in a very complicated world with many, many things going on simultaneously that have to be managed, is really short-sighted. And I think, you know, what comes out in some of the questions that we're discussing today is really that there is a, as we all know, a concerted, organized, and I would even say relentless effort on the part of her opponents to either intimidate her out of running, to try to raise questions, to grasp at straws, to find anything that is there to signal some kind of weakness in her, some kind of failure in her, so that either she won't run or that she will obviously be weakened if she does run.
All right, we've got to take a short break, so hold that thought. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Muscatine. We're discussing Hillary Clinton's new book, Hard Choices. Our guests are Lisa Muscatine, senior advisor and a speechwriter for Hillary Clinton, Jennifer Rubin, The Washington Post's Right Turn blogger, and Laura Brown, blogger and program director at George Washington University Graduate School of Political Management. We'll be right back.
Burnaby Volvo in Huntington Valley supports WHYY. Burnaby Volvo's Wonder of Summer event is going on now, featuring a variety of new models. Wonder of Summer details and full inventory at burnabyvolvo.com, 215-947-6363.
Whether you're just waking up or you're on your commute, the news is always happening. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Jennifer Lynn. WHYY and NPR's reporters are covering the stories around the block and across the globe that will fuel your day and keep you informed.
So if your alarm is set to 90.9 or we're the first preset on your car's radio,
it's radio so vibrant you can almost see it.
And our reporters never take shortcuts.
Morning Edition, weekday mornings on WHYY.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. When Russian immigrant Boris Fishman wrote a letter asking for reparations for his Holocaust survivor grandmother, he noticed how little proof he needed to provide. So he wondered, what would happen if someone tried to write fake letters? That's the inspiration for his debut novel, A Replacement Life. We'll talk to him next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Support for WHYY comes from the new Wells Fargo Propel World American Express card, designed to bring the world within reach for Wells Fargo customers. Details at a local Philadelphia area branch or wellsfargo.com/propel. Wells Fargo, the world is open. Keep exploring.
This is Radio Times from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain, and we're talking about Hillary Clinton's new book, Hard Choices. Our guests are Jennifer Rubin, the Washington Post's Right Turn blogger. Lisa Muscatine is senior advisor and speechwriter for Hillary Clinton and a close friend. And Laura Brown is blogger and program director at George Washington University's Graduate School of Political Management. By the way, if you've got any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 888-477-9499. Also, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Okay, we're going to begin the second part of the show with a clip from Fresh Air. Terry Gross talked to Hillary Clinton yesterday in a show that airs today. Let's listen.
Does the world look really different as Secretary of State than it did as Senator?
Well, it was a different perspective. Going to 112 countries and seeing our country from that vantage point, particularly during some times that were quite painful, like when Republicans were threatening to default on our debt, for example, and to see the reaction, in many instances, the shock, bewilderment, disdain, contempt that others had for what they viewed as our dysfunctional political system. That was a different perspective. As I write in the book, when I was in Hong Kong in July of 2011 and the Republicans were threatening to default on the debt, Asian business leaders who I was meeting with were just incredulous. How can this happen? Why would the United States do this to itself? What does this mean?
Well, it kind of makes you feel like an ostrich with its head in the sand, no? Lisa Muscatine? What do you think?
You know,
about
how
the rest of the world views the United States?
Well, I think her point is an important one. There has been a perception over much of the first decade of this century that America's role and certainly its leadership and potentially its influence has been diminishing around the world. We've been involved in unpopular wars overseas. We've had our own economic problems. And there was a lot of attention paid by President Obama and Hillary as secretary to trying to restore American leadership around the world, to try to patch up some alliances that had become a bit frayed, to try to engage with parts of the world where problems to different kinds of global issues might be solved with regional alliances, regional architecture. And all those kinds of things are important part of assuring that we remain the indispensable nation that she believes we are. But I think it is very fair to say that there was a period in which there were questions and perceptions around the world about that leadership and about whether we were going to continue to play that role.
Jennifer Rubin, Hillary Clinton takes a poke at Republicans. She says Republicans are threatening to default on the debt. Asian business leaders who I was meeting with were just incredulous. How can this happen? What do you think?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's very effective, free advice is what you pay for it, but I don't think it's very effective to take the tack, nothing to look at, move along, we've already talked about Hillary Clinton, people are out to get her and damage her career. This is the bad Clinton, this is how the Clintons lose. They need to, I think, accept that in the political hurly-burly, people will question your competence, your judgment, and that's politics. And to say that this is a conspiracy really misses the point and falls back into this very bad pattern. Now, as far as leadership goes and competency goes, there really are big questions. And the irony is now that our standard and our stature in the world at large has never been lower than right now.
But who's to blame?
Part of that happened under her doing, and part of that happened under her successor's doing. But it all happened under President Obama. And whether it's Putin in Russia, whether it's our European allies, whether it's our Middle East allies, if you travel there and you talk not only to Israel but to Sunni businessmen and Sunni leaders, you find that they are, to use the word, incredulous about the lack of staying power.
Jennifer, I just want to jump in for just a second. Is it just the fault of Democrats?
Well, they've been in the White House, and the White House is usually the place where foreign policy has been made. So I'm going through a whole list of policy choices, some of which were hers, and I will give her credit, some of which she said she objected to. And I think one of the more interesting parts of her book is how she objected, and did she ever consider resigning, for example, as Ambassador Ford did, because he was so appalled by our Syria policy. Those are important questions to get out, and there are competency questions about her. She deals with some of them more candidly than others. She makes pretty clear in their book that they didn't handle the Iranian Green Revolution very well.
Laura
and
Brown?
In retrospect, they should have done more.
Laura Brown, what do you think?
Well, I think that, you know, former Secretary of State Clinton is essentially putting forward what is a truism. Where you sit sort of changes your perspective on who is seeing you in what different ways. And so when she was a senator, she did see things more from the perspective of her constituents and those from New York. When she is sitting there as Secretary of State, she is out there, as she said, traveling the world, having conversations with world leaders. It makes perfect sense to me that those outside the country would have difficulty understanding the rancorous polarization and politics that really marks this time. And if you want some data on that, Pew Research just released a poll today which shows how much both sides refuse to even talk with the other side.
I'd like to take a turn off the path for just a moment and take the political temperature. We had a real shocker in the world of politics this week, as everybody knows. House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, who was widely expected to succeed John Boehner as House Speaker, was ousted in the primary for Virginia's 7th District by a Tea Party-backed candidate. What does this say about the political landscape heading into 2016? Laura, let's go to you.
Well, I actually wrote a blog about this yesterday, and what it mostly says is that anti-incumbent sentiment is as high as it's ever been in this country, and Eric Cantor, who was the majority leader in the House, was the sort of perfect crucible within which to pour all of that disgust with Washington and all that it was about. So I see this as somewhat Cantor-specific, mostly related to really the feelings that many people have in the country that Washington isn't working, Washington is broken. Those people who come here and sort of go native are part of the problem, and that many people in the country feel they need representatives who represent them, not Washington's special interests, as they always say.
One more thought before we get to our listeners. Laura, is Hillary Clinton widely viewed as an insider? Could this hurt her?
Well, it certainly is a concern that I've voiced and put out there. If I were Clinton's managers, I would be not talking about sort of her inevitability and the bright light that she shines. I would instead be talking about some of the historical underdog issues that she has to overcome, rather than this sense that the nomination's hers, the presidency's hers. Surely there will be a third term of a Democrat in the White House, which we have not seen, traditionally since World War II.
All right, let's get to the phones. David's on the line from Bucks County. Welcome to Radio Times.
Yes, hi. How are you?
Fine.
I would like to know what the guest thinks of what I feel that the Clintons and Bushes both bring such a great amount of divisiveness, that half the country, roughly, is so angry when the other party is in. I don't understand why both parties aren't searching for new candidates that are new blood that truly can bring more unity, like Barack Obama was elected for, that did not happen. I'll take the answers off the air. I appreciate it.
Thanks, David, for the telephone call. Lisa Muscatine, fair assessment?
Well, you know, I think actually that the Bushes and the Clintons represent, I don't think they represent, either of them represent the extremes of the party, and I do think that they both would like to believe that they're capable of grabbing part of the middle of the electorate. Certainly, Hillary has been able to do that perhaps a little bit more than the Bushes. That may have to do with geography for them. And I agree with the caller that there needs to be a greater attempt to rally people around a larger middle of the country. And certainly that's been a huge challenge for the Republican Party, and Eric Cantor's defeat is the most notable example of that, certainly probably ever, but certainly recently.
Jennifer Rubin? So,
yeah, I do think that caller is on to something. You know, I think people talk about the Bush fatigue, or they talk about dynasty politics. I think what people are also looking for, and this goes to the Eric Cantor issue, is something different. It's not well defined what that different is, and certainly liberals have a sense of what different would look like than conservatives, but they certainly see dysfunction. And I do think people who have been around a long time and who there are very strongly held feelings, positive and negative, are going to have to show that they can somehow put that behind them. That is, in essence, how Hillary Clinton lost in 2008. Barack Obama made a very compelling argument that he wasn't going to bring the baggage of all these years of fighting into Washington. He made the appeal, we don't have red states, we don't have blue states, we have the United States, and that was a compelling message. We can talk another time about whether he delivered on that, but that is what people ultimately want to hear. Americans, for all the polarization and divisiveness, they essentially want the government to work, and they want people to represent their interests, as your guest said. So I think it is a problem for candidates who are very divisive, and I would say it's as much a problem for Hillary Clinton as it is for someone like a Ted Cruz or someone like a Rand Paul. I think those people work well in a small pond where they can get a lot of very vibrant and very committed supporters, but in a larger pond they become very divisive, and I think both parties are going to have to really consider how they're going to not only unify their own parties but reach across the aisle and put together not only a winning campaign coalition but a governing coalition if they actually win the White House.
All right, one more quick thought from Lisa.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that I disagree entirely that Hillary operates in a small pond. I think that's just flat out wrong.
No, I was referring to the Republican gentleman.
If you look at her career in the Senate, for example, and even as First Lady when she was working on policy issues and as a secretary, she didn't have as direct a role, obviously, in domestic policy. But she is the classic pragmatist, consensus builder, reach across the aisle kind of politician. Unfortunately for the Republicans, those folks have run into a lot of problem within their own party in their primaries. It's been harder and harder to be a pragmatic, bipartisan kind of Republican in Congress right now. But Hillary was very much of that model, has always been of that model. She's not an ideologue. She is a pragmatist. I think it is why she's had appeal to a wide range of constituents. It's why she's so popular in a state like New York. Yes, it's heavily Democratic, but there's a lot of different kinds of constituents
okay.
in that state. And it's why she had such broad appeal in the 2008 election. I think Barack Obama had a message that worked and resonated with people, but I don't think it was because she was perceived as operating in a small pond.
All right, just want to give the telephone number out again. It's 888-477-9499 if you'd like to jump into the conversation. Our email is radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. And Laura Brown, I just wanted to jump in here. Clinton's critics will say her record as Secretary of State isn't particularly impressive, and they question whether she has any signature accomplishments of note as Secretary of State. What's your perspective?
Well, my perspective is really that how Hillary is judged is going to be based upon how Barack Obama is thought to be. So, in other words, really what we are facing is that, and this is why I believe she has not yet made her actual decision about running, is that we need about another 8 to 10 months to know where essentially President Barack Obama's legacy is going to start playing out, to understand where the economic sort of situation of the country is, to understand better how this foreign policy has essentially shaped up over time. And all of those things will matter, because no matter how she tries to differentiate herself from the president, she did serve in his presidency and his administration for the first term, and she will, just by virtue of being a Democrat, be seen as essentially running for a third term for the Democratic Party. And that becomes a challenge for any Democrat to differentiate themselves and at the same time to highlight the positive accomplishments.
So, Lisa, as a close friend of Hillary Clinton's, if Barack Obama's legacy falters, would that be a deterrent? What's your sense?
Well, I think it would, you know, it's potentially, I don't know if it's a deterrent. I mean, it's obviously a factor for any Democrat who runs in 2016, whether it's her or anybody else. But I think to your question, you know, it's really interesting to me the way people try to measure secretaries of state. And there's a huge amount of focus on what she would call the headlines and what we would all call the headlines. Did you achieve peace in the Middle East? You know, what happened with the wars and so on and so forth. And but what I find fascinating about the book, and one of my favorite things about the book, is that it gives such a window on what it is actually like to be in that role day in and day out, and that sort of tending to the vineyards that must take place on smaller issues, the relationships that you have to cultivate with people who are not in the headlines that may be helpful. For example, an Indonesian leader who was the first one to signal to her that there might be an opening with the autocratic regime in Burma, and that maybe that would lead to some democratic reforms there. And over time, building on those very quiet, behind-the-scenes kinds of relationships.
I did want to jump in, Lisa, with this observation. She did lay the groundwork for the interim nuclear agreement with Iran.
She sure did.
But groundwork doesn't get you the big applause.
No, this is my point. And so, but there, what I think being secretary, it's very, you know, it there's a lot of smaller kinds of labor-intensive, unglamorous, unannounced, highly hidden work that has to be done day in day out. We used to joke, you know, she would meet with foreign ministers from countries you practically never heard of, but it was all part of cultivating relationships, making sure that America's presence was being felt, that we understood the issues, and these things pay off in bigger and smaller ways. But the smaller ways really matter, and the ways that don't make the headlines really matter. And so I think to solely measure any secretary, whether it's her or anyone else, solely on the big headlines is wrong. But one other point is,
I just want to jump in real quickly, Lisa. Sure. Hold that thought, because I know Jennifer Rubin has to head out in just a second. And Jennifer, we've got about 45 seconds to get your thoughts.
Two things. One, all that little stuff is not very presidential. It doesn't bespeak of leadership. It doesn't bespeak of a foreign policy perspective or a worldview that people can rally to. George Shultz, one of our great secretaries of state, did a lot of that small stuff, but he also constructed some very big ideas, as did other secretaries of state. So it's sort of an argument that she just did a bunch of little small stuff, and I think that's actually right, but it's not very impressive. And secondly, the problem with the State Department forever has been it's all about inputs. It's all about how many meetings, how many countries you travel to, and the American public and really the world ultimately judge you on what comes out the other end. And I would strongly urge that she stop talking about all the countries she visited, because who cares ultimately?
Jennifer?
What happens is how America fares in the world.
I've got to thank you for joining us here on
Radio Times.
Jennifer Rubin is the Washington Post's Right Turn blogger. Staying with us for the remainder of the show, Lisa Muscatine is senior advisor and speechwriter for Hillary Clinton and a longtime friend, and Laura Brown is blogger and program director at George Washington University's Graduate School of Political Management. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 888-477-9499. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moscowain.
Flashpoint Theater supports WHYY and presents the world premiere of the most spectacularly lamentable trial of Ms. Martha Washington, written by Barrymore Award winner James Imes, now through June 29th. Recently widowed, the weak and ill mother of America is being cared for by the very slaves that should be guaranteed freedom at her death. Her fever dream that follows investigates her life, family, and historical legacy, and explores the complexities of America's original sin. Tickets at flashpointtheater.org.
As I'm sure you know, Hillary Clinton is on a book tour. On the next Fresh Air, she makes a stop on our show. What will I ask her? How will she respond? You and I will find out on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
thing about war documentaries.
Dead soldiers, dead civilians don't get up and walk away at the end of the scene. They stay dead.
Filmmaker author Sebastian Junger on Afghanistan, Brotherhood, and the question of whose war is it? That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Mosquain. Today we're talking about Hillary Clinton's new book, Hard Choices. Our guests are Laura Brown, a program director at George Washington University's Graduate School of Political Management, and Lisa Muscatine is a senior advisor and speechwriter for Hillary Clinton and a longtime friend. If you've got any questions or comments, we invite you to join the conversation. Simply give us a call at 888-477-9499. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Laura Brown, let's talk about health and age. Clinton says in her book that she logged 2,000 hours in the air over 4 years, covering nearly a million miles. That's a heck of a schedule. Famously suffered a concussion and blood clot in 2012, but says now that her health is good. However, any concerns about age and a presidential run? Because she would be vying to become the second oldest person in history to be elected, just a little younger than Ronald Reagan when he won his first term.
Well, let's again sort of put all the facts on the table. And the reality is presidential age and health are always a concern to all Americans because of the fear that they may not make it through the presidency, and that perhaps the vice president will end up becoming the president. We saw this in 2008 with the questions around John McCain's age. There were essentially questions about whether or not Sarah Palin would end up being president. And so, again, this is, I don't think, anything new. And yet, I don't also think that there's much to sort of concern ourselves with when it comes to Senator and former Secretary of State Clinton. She has been forthcoming about her health. She has essentially rested for the last few years. And I would imagine, like all other presidential aspirants, she will get herself sort of in shape and ready for the campaign. And over the course of the campaign, you will discover that these people have unbelievable stamina.
Lissy, you're close to Hillary. How's her energy?
I would put her up against any 20-year-old in America. I mean, she is one of these kind of forces of nature physically that left us all in the dust when we work for her. She has unbelievable energy. I think the thing that always astounded me most, actually, was not just the physical energy, but the mental acuity, even operating on very, very little sleep. And that was true in the 2008 campaign when she was probably sleeping, 3 hours a night. I've seen it working on her past books, where she would be in the Senate all day and then come home and work on her book till the wee hours of the morning and then get up at 5 or 6 and be off to another day in the Senate. And obviously she had a grueling, grueling schedule as Secretary of State. And it's hard, you're on a plane, you're breathing crappy air, you're not eating properly, you're sleeping in beds you're not used to, in countries and time zones you're not used to, and it really does take a toll. And I think we would struggle to keep up with her, quite frankly. And she's just lucky, I guess, to have that kind of durability.
Laura Brown, Liz, I wanted to get to how Bill Clinton fits into the picture if there is a run for the presidency in 2016. Laura?
Well, Bill Clinton is the most popular that he has been in, even during his presidency. So he is quite a popular figure. He is always a wonderful kind of endorser, quite frankly. Many people looked at the 2012 campaign and believed that his speech in favor of Barack Obama at the Democratic Convention was really what sort of boosted Barack Obama's message that last, few months of the campaign. So I think Bill Clinton is an asset. He obviously had some times in 2008 where he was frustrated with the course of the campaign and didn't necessarily help her message. But certainly he is well-regarded, well-respected, and thought of to be one of the best political strategists that are currently around.
And yet you have Monica Lewinsky in Vanity Fair. That's not going to go away.
No, but I do think that the country is past that. I believe that it is time for Monica Lewinsky to have a sort of her life again, and I think the country long ago was ready to move on from Monica Lewinsky.
Let's get to some messages from our listeners. We have an email from Terry in Glenmore, Pennsylvania. I am a lifelong Democrat, and I do not like Hillary or Bill Clinton. The Clinton administration helped to move this country to the right with actions such as removing the Glass-Steagall Act, which led to the out-of-control actions of Wall Street that are still going on today. We need a candidate like Elizabeth Warren who will tackle income inequality. I see Hillary as more of the same. Lisa Muscatine?
Well, I mean, that's a, you know, that's a perspective of somebody, I would say, on the lefter side of the Democratic Party, and mm-hmm. Elizabeth Warren's terrific. I've met her myself. I've read her book. By the way, I just want to clarify one thing. I'm not currently working for Hillary. I actually run a bookstore in Washington, D.C. But
but you're close to her. You're a friend of hers,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I certainly am still in touch, obviously. But I think the message reflects a certain point of view that, you know, that the country needs to push a little more to the left. I think there's been well-documented disappointment on the left with certain aspects of the Obama administration and President Obama himself on some issues. But I think that to govern this country and to lead the country, you can't be on one pole or the other. You really have to govern from the middle. And I think the pragmatic politicians are not only the ones who can get elected, they're the ones who can most effectively govern. It doesn't hurt, though, to have perspectives like the one we just heard that keep the center mindful of what the left or on the opposite side of the aisle people are thinking. And so I think these are forces that are very important to have. You don't want to just have a kind of a monolithic middle either. Can I just quickly get back to one thing? I just wanted to comment on one thing that Jennifer said before she left, because it really, and forgive me, but it does bear correcting.
Okay, bearing in mind she's not here to retort, but...
No, but I'm just going to say, she was suggesting that I had said that Hillary only accomplished small things. That is not at all what I was saying. What I was saying was that those things do matter. I do believe they are a measure of leadership. Getting the little things done and the day-to-day things really do affect leadership and are a measure of leadership. But I think to get to the big things, you know, when Hillary became secretary, there were two wars going on. Our economy was in a free fall. Our alliances, some important alliances, were fraying. We were worried about Iran moving more quickly toward a nuclear weapon. China was on the rise. And there were questions around the world about America's leadership. And she not only helped restore that leadership, she engaged Asia for the first time in a way that we never had. She did help build a global coalition to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. She helped negotiate a ceasefire in Gaza. And she also did something that I think is really important and often overlooked, which is sort of be a champion for America's moral leadership, to champion human rights and women's rights, internet freedom, religious freedom, gay people, and certainly young people around the world. And these are all, to me, hallmarks of leadership.
Okay. Laura Braun, I wanted to get to something we just started to touch on a little bit ago. Hillary Clinton is not expected to make a decision to run until after the midterm elections. If she decides not to run, it's widely considered that there is a vacuum in the Democratic Party. I mean, who would fill that vacuum? She's the person I believe they're looking to at this point. But who else is out there if she decides not to run?
Well, there's certainly a lot of Democrats who are, for lack of a better phrase, chomping at the bit to kind of get in the race because mm-hmm. they know that they either need to get their name sort of nationally heard and known so that they could potentially be a VP pick, or if the Democrats were to lose, to be the next in line, if you will, in 2020. I think when we talk about specifics, you can look at former governor of Montana, Brian Schweitzer. You can look at Senator Elizabeth Warren, who we just mentioned. There's also Senator Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota. There are also governors like Andrew Cuomo in New York and Martin O'Malley from Maryland. So there are individuals who really do want to be part of this race and, if nothing else, part of the next generation of Democratic leadership.
Laura, and on another note, we have a tweet that says, "The hatred of Obama is just a sample of what we'll see if Hill runs. Common decency and restraint are no longer GOP traits." That cuts both ways, doesn't it?
Well, it does. And again, this Pew Research report interviewed 10,000 Americans. And one of the things that comes through is that essentially Americans, when they identify with one party, they want to live near other partisans. They want to have friends who are also partisans. In fact, they are even concerned about intermarriage within the family, if you will, across party lines. So we have become a country that really distrusts and sees sort of the worst in the other political parties, members. And unfortunately, these feelings of antipathy are strongest among those who are most politically active. So this is where the middle of the country, who has to a large extent disengaged from Washington, also really looks at Washington as a bunch of people in a sandbox throwing dirt at each other.
Well, and that works perfectly with this next tweet we have from Lojo. Lojo says, "We need new blood in the presidency. If Hillary was to run, we will continue to waste energy defending her." Lisa Muscatine, what do you think about that?
You know, I think it's, and she says this in the book, and I really agree with it, I think it's important to focus not on who the president is going to be, but on what their vision is and what their, you know, what they view what they want our world to look like, and to sort of assess the values, the characteristics, and the direction that they want to take, and whether they have a vision for the future. And that's where I would start. And I think to get into sort of the personality-driven aspects of it, it's hard to ignore it, and it's hard not to, given that she's such an object of fascination to everyone. But I do think it's right. I mean, it should be less about her and more about what her vision is. It should be more about whoever the Republican nominee's vision is. It should be, if she doesn't run, about whatever the vision is of the person who is the standard bearer for the Democratic Party. And I think to sort of get out of the personality-driven aspects of this would be very helpful for the country for all of the reasons we've been discussing.
Okay.
Can I just push back on that for a minute?
Sure.
Because it is true that the political science literature has an entire branch of it that actually discusses the fact that character ends up being some of the most important aspects of the presidency. And the reason why is that the issues change. George W. Bush never believed that he would be a war president. He was running on things like No Child Left Behind and believed most of his presidency would be about domestic policy. President Barack Obama never would have foreseen the economic crisis, and almost all of his presidency has been about responding to the massive sort of economic fall in 2008. In other words, the worlds change and issues change, and what is oftentimes argued in this sort of field of political science is that you must understand the character of the leader and how they make decisions and how they approach essentially management and all of this politics world, because if you don't, you're going to be surprised when it comes to an issue that they haven't addressed in the campaign.
Okay. Another issue which might or might not haunt Hillary Clinton, her vote back in 2002 to authorize military action in Iraq if diplomatic efforts, meaning UN weapons inspections, failed. She says, she came to deeply regret giving President Bush the benefit of the doubt on that vote. It seems as this rings true, because 5 years later, when Bush asked for support for the surge, his proposed surge, she wasn't supportive. Is this a lifetime ago in politics, Lisa?
I think it is. I mean, I think she's explained in this book, and she's tried to explain it during the campaign as well in 2008, and she's explained in this book the sort of evolution of that issue in her mind and the way she approached it and acted on it. And I think people have gotten a very good sense of her as Secretary of State and the sorts of decision-making that she does now and has for the past 4 years, and hopefully people do understand. I mean, one of her biggest defenders on that vote in her explanation of it at the time was David Brooks in the New York Times. But I think it was a lifetime ago.
We're coming toward the close of the show. Lara, what do you think?
Well, the real question is going to be, where is Iraq going to go going forward? I mean, I think, some of the issues that came up in the book where she does talk about herself as being, if you will, more hawkish than the Obama administration. That's going to, I would imagine, fare well were she to go up against a Republican after winning a nomination. It might fare more poorly in a Democratic nomination contest. And so she has a tough road to walk there, balancing those two strains in the country, especially amidst current events.
Okay, and this is the question so many are thinking of. If you were a betting woman, what are the odds you think Hillary Clinton will run for president in 2016, Laura?
I would say that it's really not more than 60-40.
60-40?
64, yeah.
Alyssa?
You know,
with the insider track?
I wish I could answer it with some mm-hmm. authority, which unfortunately I can't, and I have kind of given up trying to divine these kinds of things. But, you know, I think it's, you know, as somebody who cares about the country, I really hope she does run. And as somebody who cares about her as a person and knows what it takes to run a campaign and knows what she would be up against, you know, I feel for her if she makes the decision to run. So, I myself am a little mixed about it, although for the country I certainly hope she does. And, you know, I think there's a chance she will.
And quickly, too, in 2008 when she addressed the disappointment of losing the Democratic nomination, she said in reference to a female candidate, the path will be a little easier next time. Do you think so for the next woman who campaigns for president, regardless of who that is, Laura?
Well, yes, but let me just say that I hope many women choose to get involved in this race, because the only way a woman will get there is if we have numbers in each party's nominating contest.
What do you think, Lisa?
Hear, hear. Agree completely. The more women in the political process, the better for everybody, for the country as well. And I do think it'll be easier. I also think, you know, people know Hillary. If it does happen to be Hillary, they know her in a far different context now. Obviously, she wasn't in a political role, and that always makes you more popular. But I think people have seen that she's a team player, that she went to work for the guy who beat her, that she was a trooper, that she, you know, worked her tail off for this country yet again, and have come to, I think, appreciate her in a wider way.
Okay, we'll see. We've been talking about Hillary Clinton and her new book, Hard Choices. Our guests have been Laura Brown, Program Director at George Washington University's Graduate School of Political Management. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you so much.
And Lisa Muscatine is Senior Advisor and Speechwriter for Hillary Clinton. Thank you, and glad to have you with us, Lisa.
Thank you for having me.
Learn more about Radio Times on Facebook and Twitter. And if you'd like to check out our podcast, head to our homepage, whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane.